and adjust these transfers until the model does in fact give plausible agreement with world history for the developed world and the underdeveloped world. And what I show here is the, let's call it, two-region world model or dual world model. When we have adjusted these transfer flows satisfactorily, the original Forrester curve is shown by the dotted line. Incidentally, it should be noted that with the assumptions in the Forrester model, both flows of capital and resources have to be in the direction of the developed world, while the flow of pollution is in the direction of the underdeveloped world. The model is very crude, but this point certainly needs to be looked at further. Let's change just one assumption in this dual world model, that pollution is not distributed uniformly across the world, but it remains in the region of its creation, so that all pollution created in the developed world stays there, all pollution created in the underdeveloped world stays there, and run the model again. We have quite different results. What this shows is that because most pollution, and in the model it's assumed to come from industrialization, is created in the developed world suffers a population collapse from pollution at quite an early date, in fact not very far into the future. However, the underdeveloped world continues to grow until it too suffers the same fate. We shouldn't think of this as a replication of the real world. What it shows is that it does matter what level of aggregation one treats these models at. What we should also note is that the form of collapses very much change, that in fact a local catastrophe, a catastrophe in the developed world model, appears far in advance of the collapse forecast by the world averaged model. I should also point out that although this particular test has been carried out on Forrester's model, it of course applies equally to Meadows' model. There's no reason why it should be otherwise. Let's now go on to consider Meadows' model, because this is the model which has come from, as Dr. Taylor says, an 18-month study, and about which the rather definitive statements I read to you earlier have been made. As Dr. Taylor has pointed out, we at Sussex have had privileged access to the technical report. Unfortunately, I think no one else here will have read it, and so I think it's very difficult for me both to tell you what's in the report and to criticize it at the same time. So I will have to be very selective about the criticisms I make and just try to give you an overall impression of our criticisms of this work. We've subjected the model, that is Meadows' model, to tests similar to those we have shown for Forrester. What Meadows claims for his model is that it represents the world system as it has operated for the last 100 years, although it's true to say that nowhere in his work does he actually run the model over a period of 100 years, going back from 1970. We have done this just to check his model, and the results are as shown here. In fact, it behaves far better than Forrester's model. Population increases steadily from 1850 onwards. There are one or two problems which, of course, I've added to this graph. One is food per capita shows a rather strange decline from 1850 onwards. The fraction of unemployed behaves rather more strangely. In fact, according to the model, in 1850, the unemployment fraction was -4. In other words, there were 5 times as many people employed as there were people to be employed. Now, this should not be overlooked in considering the model, because clearly, as the model agrees with history over the period 1900 to 1970, there must be other errors embedded somewhere in the model which compensate for this particular error. Just to refresh your memories, the model is rather complicated in many ways when one tries to find out which particular parameter, probably in the industry sector, is compensating for an error in this variable here. Our team at Sussex has comprised a very mixed group of people, ranging on the one hand from statisticians and ex-mathematical physicists, through economists, through biologists, chemists, to, on the other extreme, social psychologists. Each aspect of the model has been studied by those members of the team who appeared to be most competent. And if I don't mention all their names, it's not because I want to take credit from them. Most of the credit is in fact theirs. They've done a very thorough job on looking at all these relationships, trying to establish the data upon which they were based, trying to check the relationships against theory, where theory exists, trying to examine the model's assumptions that there will be discontinuities in technical progress, and to examine whether these discontinuities in technical progress appear to be justified. I'll briefly run through a few of the criticisms about each sector of the model. To do this, it's useful to consider a rather simplistic diagram of the model. Population creates capital. Capital is distributed in various ways. One is to agriculture, one is to services, and one is to production of material goods. Pollution is created from investment, in Forrester's model merely from pollution, in Meadows' model also from agriculture. So what we've done is to examine each of these areas in turn. Population, we find, has been modeled as well as could be expected, considering the lack of information, considering that very little is really known about the factors that cause people to want children and to have them. However, although one cannot criticize the content of this subsystem, its behavior, when one runs it as a separate model, is very sensitive to variables about which little is known. And so, when one runs this subsystem within the model as a whole, one has to be slightly less confident about the results of the model as a whole. The same is true of the capital subsystem. Although we cannot find any parameters in this system which one can definitely say are wrong, there are many parameters in the system which, if they are changed, completely alter the behavior of the model. For instance, if one considers the parameter which shows the amount of industrial output coming from a given amount of capital, which takes the value 3. Now, this is based on Samuelson's estimate for the US economy in the period 1900 to 1970. Throughout the world, values for this capital output ratio vary in this period, 1900 to 1970, from 2 to 8, a wide range. Furthermore, if one changes this value in the model to 2, no growth at all is possible. If one changes it to 4, then collapse takes place before 1970. The model is very sensitive to this parameter, and of course one could argue that since the model seems to give correct results, probably they've taken the right value. But again, the same criticism as I made earlier applies. This parameter could have taken the wrong value, and other parameters throughout the model could be in error and compensating for this particular error. Again, to take another example, one of the reasons I deal with the capital subsystem more thoroughly than the others is because it is the economists who have been most critical about the model and who have been castigated by Gabor and others for their criticisms of it. And what I'm trying to show is that we feel the economists' criticisms of the models are indeed justified. The MIT model shows the effect of physical constraints on growth. Consequently, capital, as defined in the model, is defined in terms of physical capital, i.e. in terms of machines. And so, lifetime of capital in the model should be defined in terms of physical lifetime. In fact, it's defined in terms of economic lifetime, a value taken from US statistics over the last 10 years. And it's fixed at that value throughout the model. Now, in fact, economic lifetime responds to variations in the economic situation. And it would always tend to respond in such a way as to take up slack in times of trouble. So if resources became short or if capital became scarce, economic lifetime would tend to approach physical lifetime, that is, lifetime before a machine or a piece of equipment falls to pieces. Because of the feedback structure in the model, that is, the way that these various loops interact with one another, this is a very rigid assumption. It tends, on the one hand, to accelerate growth when we're in a period of growth, and on the other, to accelerate collapse when one is in a period of decline. As I said before, technical progress is not included in the model, except in one instance, and this is in the capital sector, in the industrial sector. And I'm not even sure that Meadows was aware of the fact that he had included technical progress in this sector. But as one can see, if one has technical progress in the industrial sector, one tends to want to use up resources more rapidly, because the amount of resource consumed per unit of capital will increase. Yet at the same time, if one doesn't have technical progress in the natural resource sector to compensate for this, one exaggerates the rate of depletion of resources. The fourth problem that I should mention is the problem of data in this sector. Data is very hard to come by, as I've said before. One has to assume that cross-section data, that is, information which compares the economic standing of India now compared with the US now as regards consumption patterns, is the same as the relation between the US when it had standard of living that India has now and at the present time. It's very difficult to find alternative sources of information, but there are many reasons to suppose that this is a very dubious assumption. The last feature of the capital sector, which I should mention, is that it assumes fixed economic values, that people's consumption patterns now and in the future will be based on the same set of values. Now again, economists know this not to be the case, and they know that values, economic and social, do change over time. Now, in both population and capital sectors, I've pointed to factors in the model which cannot be said to be definitely wrong, but which can be said to be uncertain, at the very least. And both are uncertain to the extent that if one changes these within the error one might place on these parameters, the model behaves entirely differently. In resources, agriculture and pollution, the situation is slightly different. Meadows says that his model shows the physical constraints operating on the world, that there are 250 years supply of natural resources left. In the model is a relationship such as this. When we have 250 years supply of materials, in other words, when the renewable resource fraction remaining is one, the fraction of our total expenditure that we must allocate to consumption is fairly low, about 0.05. As we begin to run out of resources, in other words, this fraction gets lower and lower, the cost rises until eventually we are spending virtually all our income on resources. In the period 1900 to 1970, we move this far along the curve. What's the real situation over this period? Well, opinions differ. One view is that costs are rising slightly. This is the opinion of Resources for the Future, Inc., Ayres and Neys, who, upon whose work Meadows has based his estimates. Although it should be pointed out that Neys has refuted the interpretation that Meadows has placed on his work. Perhaps the best authority is Landsberg, and he shows fluctuations in resource prices over the period 1870 to 1960. They fluctuate quite considerably. One problem is that we're not sure what the scale of this is, but even if one considers this to be zero, then there seems to be very little reason to suppose or to interpret these results as giving a factor of 2 or a 1.5 increase in prices over the period 1900 to 1970. Maisel's, another researcher, believes in fact that resource costs have gone down over this period. What I'm trying to show is that there is a great degree of uncertainty, but that in our opinion it does look as though resource costs need not rise as dramatically as Meadows assumes, especially when one considers that, of course, the physical resource content of the Earth is not 250 years, it's not 2,500 years, it's far greater than this. And if one looks at man's ability in the past to extract resources, grades of ore used have gone down and down and down. And again, there is no reason to suppose why we should not continue to make similar improvements in the future. We could talk of an optimistic view and a pessimistic view, but our view, at least in terms of physical resources, has to be termed an optimistic one. Of course, there's every need to improve our technologies. There's every need not to waste resources, but there's no reason to suppose that we cannot cope with the resource problem. What of pollution? Well, I think perhaps pollution is a red herring in the MIT models. The OECD recently published figures showing the fraction of GMP which Western countries, that is the OECD countries, would have to spend in order to keep the level of pollution below reasonable limits. For the United States, this figure is 1.6% of GMP. For Germany, 1.8%, for Italy, 0.6%, for the Netherlands, 0.5%. It's a fairly small amount. Furthermore, this is the amount to be spent over the next few years, whilst we're overcoming the backlog of pollution, which has been created during a time when we seem to have cared little of its consequences. Even if one considers these estimates to be optimistic, the US Environmental Protection Agency I think one factor being that it has set slightly higher standards on what it considers to be freedom from pollution, has nearly doubled these figures. What of agriculture? Again, I can't go into this in detail, but from our analysis, we believe that the MIT group have been pessimistic in their interpretation of possibilities for food production in the future, especially with respect to the diminishing returns from input into agriculture and from the benefits that could be obtained by reallocation of capital on a worldwide basis to make maximum use of agricultural land available. This is even without considering other possibilities for food production. Now, what's the result of putting these changes into the model? What I'm going to do is to make changes in five of the equations in the Meadows model out of the 140 equations which it contains. Now, the original run, we remember, showed collapse due to natural resource depletion. On a scale which reduces all the variables, the run looks like that. It's, in fact, the graph I showed you earlier, but squashed slightly, and the time horizon extended to the year 2200. Again, not because validity of the model is improved, but simply so that we can see the effect of all these changes. Firstly, let us put in our best estimate of what we can do about natural resources. As we see, and as we would expect, there is a population collapse due to pollution. Let us assume that we can deal with pollution, that we can cut down the emission of pollution by a factor of 10. In fact, we believe it can be cut further than this, but we would take this rather arbitrary figure. And one reason that the figure must be arbitrary is because very little information is available on the pollution question. One really does have to make guesses about what the Earth's capacity to absorb pollution really is. But as we've seen, the OECD estimates seem to indicate that we can deal with this pollution at a reasonable cost. Of course, when we make this change, we run into a population collapse due to food shortages. Again, not surprisingly. So we must feed into the model our estimates of what we can do about diminishing returns to investment, what we can do if we redistribute capital on a better worldwide basis. And of course, I should point out that redistribution, although it doesn't present any physical problems, it does present political problems. What we find is rather startling, that growth can continue at a moderately rapid rate well into the future. Of course, things are going a bit haywire, but this shouldn't be taken in any way to be a forecast of the future. It simply shows the effect on the model of making five changes that, after studying the model and studying its assumptions, we believe as a group to be reasonable. In our opinion, the Meadows model predicts a fairly high rate of growth with a probability at least equal to that for which it predicts catastrophe. In this case, it can hardly be considered a reasonable model on which to base any theories about the need to seek an equilibrium society. As I've said, perhaps we've been optimistic in that we believe that technical progress in some areas can continue. And this, I should point out, is in contrast to both Meadows and Forrester's beliefs. But I've also shown that if one disaggregates the model, one sees quite different results. And of course, if growth was to continue, there's no reason to suppose that regional problems would not continue. And Dr. Taman has pointed earlier to this particular problem. So, to summarize our view, we would say that the physical problems of growth appear to be rather small compared with, on the one hand, technological and economic problems, but especially compared with social and political problems, which are not considered in the MIT models as they stand. And in fact, we believe that one failing of the model has been that it has diverted people's attention from what we consider to be real problems, social, political problems, problems of underdevelopment, toward physical problems, problems of environment, which, although they are very real, can be dealt with. It's very important for us to realize, those of us who would advocate an equilibrium society, exactly which of us would be better off in such a society and which of us would not be. And there seems to be unanimous agreement amongst economists, especially those concerned with problems of underdevelopment, that to cease growth in the developed world would only hamper the chances of the underdeveloped world from ever reaching a reasonable standard of living, let alone the standard that we now enjoy. Even in this figure, it's not before the year 2100 that the world average industrial output per capita reaches the present figure of the US. There's one other point following from this that I'd like to bring up before I finish. And this is whether the model should have been published at all at the time that it was published. Meadows is quite convinced, at least appears to be quite convinced, from the statements I read to you earlier about the validity of his results. Yet, in the postscript to Limits to Growth, in a chapter signed by Dr. Taman, by Pachey, by Alexander King, by Carol Wilson, they state that the Club of Rome is quite aware of deficiencies in the model. Deficiencies, aggregation, possibilities for technological advance, possibilities that the resources have been pessimistically estimated, and the possibilities for automatic social value changes. The tests I've shown have been very quick tests. I hope they're not glib. But anyone with Forrester or Meadows competence at using the technique of systems dynamics and with their familiarity of with the model could have made each of these tests in half a day or less. Surely, however urgent the problems which they speak of, it wouldn't have mattered to have delayed publication for a fortnight or so, just to make sure that things were really as they say. I don't believe it's sufficient to say, well, the model has at least caused people to think. If it's caused them to think about the wrong problems and diverted their attention from the real problems, it's no use using bad science to support social argument. One ends up with a Lysenko style of science. It not only discredits scientists in the eyes of the general public, but it discredits scientists in the eyes of scientists. I think it's necessary for us to fight this, but at the same time to try and improve our understanding of the future. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Curl, for this extremely interesting analysis of your study. I think one might almost put it this way, that the Club of Rome provided us with a bath full of water. The MIT put the baby into the bathwater. Dr. Curl is suggesting that some of this bathwater might be thrown away. Perhaps what we have to be careful of course, is that we don't throw away the baby with the bathwater. There seems no doubt that there is a lot which can be questioned in what has been done so far, and I think that Dr. Tiemann would be the first to agree with Dr. Cole, of course, that these things must be questioned. The last point which Dr. Cole raised is, of course, a very interesting one, and one which we've seen countless times in this whole problem of the mass media. To what extent, in fact, is, as it were, premature publication harmful, in fact, to the very aims that you're seeking to achieve. However, I think the main point of the discussion today has been, in fact, to hear what the Club of Rome set out to do and to hear, in fact, the criticism that the Science Policy Research Unit in Sussex has now been able to make. Now, if the natural resources and food supplies down in the canteen can cope with the influx of capital and the rising population, we'll have a coffee break now, a short break for a quarter of an hour, and assemble just after 10:30, then you'll have an opportunity to ask questions and to discuss with the two speakers. Thank you. Of the presence of Dr. Tiemann and Dr. Curl to ask some questions, we should start. I think we ought to try to come to an end around 11:30. Most people, I think, will want to get home by then. You've heard then the genesis, you've heard the development, perhaps the exodus is yet to come, and now we'd be very glad to hear your points of view. The technique, incidentally, is when you're given the floor, if you would push the button in front of you, then the interpreters will hear you. And gentlemen, right up at the back there.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Dr. Tiemann, Dr. Cole, I'd like to ask a question comparing the results of the two models, not questioning the assumptions. There is a very marked difference between the projections, if I may use that word, between the two models, in the sense that there is a 50% discrepancy in the level of population reached before collapse occurs in the model, and there's approximately a 100% discrepancy in the time forecast. It seems to me that purely from the point of view of control engineering, this suggests that a relationship between such projections and the ratio of number of positive and to negative feedback loops in the system. I was wondering why, considering that the models, one is an extension of the other, that this very marked discrepancy between the two results was not commented on previously. Thank you.
Well, Ray, I guess you probably know the answer to this question. My own view is slightly different. I think it's simply that since Forrester's estimates were guessed, he guessed them either wrongly or just differently from those which Meadows chose. But I agree with you, it's an interesting problem. And incidentally, it's one which Mr. Kerner, the questioner, and the Control Engineering Department at the University of Sussex hope to look at within the next year or so.
Yes.
I have several remarks about the lecture of Dr. Cole, and I asked the chairman to stop me if I talked too long. Let's start just from the end of the exposé. Dr. Cole said that it was a pity that the report of the Club of Rome was released too quickly. It took about 2 years' work. Maybe it was not enough, but I congratulate him in any case for producing such a quick critics, which maybe would need even more time to be studied in depth. The second remark is that
you'd like to answer each question as it's put rather than wait to the end, is that what you'd like?
Maybe it would be easier to do this.
Perhaps then we'll ask Dr. Cole or Dr. Tiemann if he wants to add anything to take your questions one by one. But I would ask you, of course, that we haven't got very much time. Don't please spend the next half hour putting questions.
You can thank just you. Stop
Dr. Cole.
No problem.
Concerning speed of publication, I feel like criticism is valid. And I feel it's particularly valid because, as I say, in the postscript to Limits to Growth, several members of the Club of Rome expressed their doubts about the model, and yet at the same time the book was published under pressure from the Club of Rome. In an article published in Science magazine, I believe March the 17th of this year, describing the meeting at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington at which the model and its results were announced, it says, quite clearly, that Meadows told Science that the idea of bringing out a popular book with a blast of publicity was mostly Pache's idea, Pache's the head of the Club of Rome. It seems strange, therefore, that on the one hand the Club of Rome should admit to failings in the model, yet the model is published with definitive statements about the results under pressure from the Club of Rome. Another aspect of this, we have brought out our critique as quickly as we could. We believe that it is a good critique. Of course, it cannot be thorough. And not only have we brought it out quickly, we have posted a copy of our critique to Dennis Meadows at his request, and it will be possible for him to answer our critique in his publication, A Technical Report of the Club of Rome, when it comes out in March next year. We've fed Meadows with our results as they've arrived. He visited us at Sussex and we told him our criticisms. We hope, therefore, that when the technical report is finally published, it will be a much better job. It will contain a much better model than that which was used to back up the original publication, Limits to Growth. Perhaps there's one other point I might be permitted to make here, that we are publishing our results as a book to be called Malthus with a Computer. Publication date in America will be the same as the technical report of the Club of Rome. Publication date in Europe will be January 73, followed as soon as possible by a hardback. Thank you.
We ought to spend too much of our rather short time discussing the politics of this operation, which obviously exists. And I think we ought perhaps to direct our questions mainly to the more technical points of Dr. Cole or Dr. Tiemann's talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much for an answer which was much longer than the question. And the second point is the following one. When one hears all this criticism about this model, one really begins to be convinced that this model is the worst of all, except all the others. And this is the first point. The second one is after all the others, what are they? We are in the realm of social sciences here. And as a matter of fact, if you play forward or backward, any model, be econometric or system analysis, for more than 10 or 20 years, you just can spend your time writing nice stories for healthy magazines. To play around to see how much nonsense they produce for periods where they are supposed to foresee situations which are far ahead or behind than 10 or 20 years. This is true of just simply any social any model concerning social sciences. It is very sad, but social sciences are not that far. So it's not an argument of saying that if you play backward the Forrester model to the Roman Empire, probably you would find, I don't know what, that may be the Roman emperor was maybe the only one living in his time. Now, I would like to just understand that when we are in the realm of social sciences, we are in a realm which is not that scientific, and if you use for criticism a system of judgments which appeals to and refers to something else, it would just like asking Shakespeare to criticize Einstein.
Several points I would like to make with respect to this last statement, because I think it contains one or two erroneous assumptions, to say the least. In the first place, I would admit, as would every social psychologist under the sun, that it is a difficult subject, it's a difficult realm. And for this very reason, it seems to us incredible that the model should have been announced as giving definitive results and at the same time announced with so much publicity. One of the reasons for choosing a computer model to publicize the fears of the Club of Rome was simply because they were well aware of the fact that the public at large believes what comes out of a computer. They believe what scientists tell them. And in fact, I'd like to quote again from this Science article. It says, for 2 years, club members had plodded quietly from Moscow to Rio, from Stockholm to Washington, seeking out political leaders and appraising them of the dangers ahead. Dr. Taman has told us about this. Pachey says, our message was received with sympathy and understanding, but no action followed. What we needed was a stronger tool of communication to move men on the planet out of their ingrained habits. This is the reason for the MIT study and the book. The MIT study is an example of pseudoscience. If the MIT group want to pretend to use science to push certain ideological views, they must expect their work to stand up to scientific criticism. In fact, in the technical report, Meadows says this explicitly, that every assumption in the model, I'm not quoting but I'm paraphrasing, should withstand individual criticism, that it should be testable against data. Even Meadows seems to think that his model is scientific and ought to stand up to scientific criticism. I think I could carry on in this vein, but perhaps we should move on to another question.
I think if our questioner would forgive me, I would like to hear some other questions first, and then if time permits, well, he can continue his interesting discussion with Dr. Coe. Gentleman down here in the front.
I would like to ask a rather basic question. If the Volkswagen would stop to run and run and run, who would support, who would be expected, say, to support research of that kind? One could imagine, for instance, the United Nations. But as I can understand, the problem stated finally in its full complexity would be a kind of optimization problem to be of sense, finally. And there I think the trouble would come in, because optimization would have been the difficulty would lie in the definition of optimization, because that would be different from man to man. So what does one think, where to find future support, financial support?
I'd like to go
I will make a few remarks on this point. First, as you know, the whole problem is of such complexity that I believe it makes not much sense to discuss on any of the details of a model, because a model can run only a very limited time to represent with certain data you feed into it what we perceive today. Now, if you understand the Hudson Institute's projection for the future, then you see there are order of magnitudes in question. Is it possible, and perhaps many people are not doubting, that the world population may go up to 60 billion people? But the question is whether we want to have to be crowded with 60 billion. Though, if a model could find out that the Earth with all kind of technologies would sustain 60 billion people, it's not necessary that the human being wants to do so. Though you see the judgment of maybe a kind of an idea of a limited population to 6 billion or something of this kind, to 60 billion, is such an order of magnitude for variation, though I believe I was interested to see that in this work of this modeling done in Sussex, there is also within these limitations. However, I believe, we have not to forget, I believe we ask too much of a model if it is really a prediction tool. Because, as I said, in the opinion of the Club of Rome, there are so many human elements into it which are not considered in such a technological model. But I believe we have not to forget that in many things of the history of sciences, we see kind of so-called scientists or pseudo-scientists, as they were called, fighting one against the other. Who is right? Who is wrong? Who makes assumptions of this kind? Who makes assumptions of others? And we will certainly look carefully into the results of Sussex to see the reactions of MIT and other people who are now active into it. And I would see that probably every group working in it would find some other results and some other assumptions. Why not? It is opening up our knowledge of it. But I would say the level to discuss the details of a model compared with higher levels which have to be considered seems to me a question which comes down to so many parameters which are guesses with the best possible way. And though we find perhaps always the same behavior, that one group wants to find out why the other group was wrong, but they could also point out what may be right in it. And perhaps if we would listen to the other part, they would perhaps claim other elements too. And certainly the Club of Rome, if you take on some press releases, I can show you so many positive releases as negative ones. It seems to me not very scientific to take a phrase from a publication X, Y, Z, at that moment, say that these press people said something, and that is right. I believe that seems to me not, I wouldn't enter in any discussion in this point of view. That could be done by others, but that's not the purpose of the Club of Rome.
Well, we seem to be stacking up potential questions at a great rate. I think I'd perhaps like to continue with the questions, and please make them as short as possible.
Firstly, I think we ought to congratulate the Club of Rome model on getting 135 out of its 140 equations through a fairly stringent sort of test. I'd rather you didn't,
well,
actually.
Because
I want
not
to,
the
that
point.
Was just a verbal this, aside, and
but
I would
this
like
not
to.
The point. What I was saying is we changed only 5 out of 140 equations. This doesn't mean that we believe the others to be correct. In fact, we believe many of them not to be correct.
The question was, in fact, you have rather neatly dodged the whole point of the Club of Rome calculation by assuming that physical limits were not, in fact, physical limits, but could be conveniently expanded at 1 or 2% a year by this or that technique. Therefore, reserves and population could grow according to such a model forever, ignoring the fact that the population living at that time might not want it to. Now, there was a point about the resources growing forever. You say that resources constitute, in fact, the volume of the Earth. This is true, but they might not be usable in the sense that in nearly all cases, energy is needed to extract these resources. There are many billions of tons of coal and oil in Canada, which it would take more than the thermal content of that coal or oil to extract. These are not, in fact, economically valuable reserves. Now, the economically valuable reserves that we do have left, in America, they are, in fact, importing thermal reserves already and will be importing more than 50% in 8 years. And in Europe, this figure will be reached before the turn of the century. Now, since this is, in fact, it's energy which makes our economies run, and it's energy which is being used fastest of all our reserves, and it's energy which is, in fact, going to run into the physical buffers first. The calculations vary, but they are some 30 to 50 years. I don't see how, in terms of this very necessary material to extract your reserves of other commodities, how you are in fact going to utilize the infinite volume of resources of which you cheerfully talk.
You're right, in fact, that energy is perhaps one of the most, if not the most, important natural resource. And in fact, we were well aware of this when we did our Sussex study, and we point out that the problem of energy reserves is not considered in any great detail in Limits to Growth. So in our book, we have devoted a chapter solely to the problems of energy reserves. The chapter is written by two economists who specialize in the problems of energy. They're working under a research program funded by British Petroleum. It's an open project. It's looking at long-term requirements and long-term possibilities for satisfying these requirements. They point out that we should be able to make our reserves last beyond the time at which we would hope, reasonably hope, to have in operation fast breeder reactors or even fusion reactors. Of course, it's based on the hope or on the belief that such devices will become available within a certain time span. If one looks in detail at fossil fuels that are available to us, they go far beyond the estimates of oil, coal, and natural gas. One must take into account the tar sands of Alberta. One must take into account oil shale reserves, which are known or believed on the basis of good estimate to be 10 times proven oil reserves. There really doesn't seem to be a reason to think that energy is a critical problem. The problem with energy, as you've pointed out, is its location. It's not always located exactly where Western countries would like it to be. It's in Siberia, it's in the Middle East. Again, this points to the fact that many of the world's problems are political rather than physical or even technological. No new technologies, no great breakthroughs in technology are needed to extract oil from oil shale, petroleum from coal. What's needed is a political breakthrough.
This is, of course, one of the most important parts and most interesting parts of this whole problem. Dr. Thiemann has some words to add.
I would like to comment on this energy situation. I have seen a tremendous study with many, many people going on in the United States about this energy situation. And I believe it seems to me a very typical example where maybe only 10 years ago it was thought there is no problem. Even United States felt there is no problem. Today there is no longer gas available, and gas has to be made available in Siberia or in Algeria. Only in a few years. And these large energy studies now going on show just the contrary, which has been shown. It was demonstrated on a table that the price will remain about constant. But only for 1980, these studies, and there were a tremendous amount put into it, predict an increase of petroleum price for factor 3 to 5 in the next 8 to 10 years. And certainly, there is not a limitation absolutely for resources. But you need a much more energy and effort to get it when the concentration becoming bad.
if now, in 5 years from now, United States has to import large quantities of petroleum from the Middle East, because the shale oil and all these more difficult locations of oil needs a tremendous development in the energy to do it, and it will only be made when the costs are going up. The North Sea petroleum, which, as we know all, a lot of exploration is going on, but there is no possibility to extract for the moment that oil on the same basis as in the Middle East, where you put a hole in it and all the oil is spilling out. That's the cheapest way to get the sources, though nobody could believe that the price you have to pay for these resources are not going up. I believe if these specialists of energies would be present, would certainly immediately jump on this one. Therefore, I believe absolute indications are very, very difficult to give. A very short one.
I think we should be very careful when we're talking about price increases in, for instance, the United States. If the United States has to pay more for its fuel because it's importing it from, say, the Middle East, and because the Middle East countries get together in the form of OPEC, we should perhaps be pleased, at least those of us who wish to see the underdeveloped countries taking off. It means that some of the United States wealth is being diverted to less fortunate parts of the world.
Au docteur Timan. Je voudrais demander au docteur Timan d'être peut-être me donner plus de précisions sur les implications politiques qui sont derrière la démarche du Club de Rome. Parce que vous nous avez parlé très discrètement que ça devait aider les decision makers, les maîtres des décisions. Et dans les publications précédentes du Club de Rome, c'était affirmé avec beaucoup plus de force que cette démarche était destinée à aider les decision makers à prendre des décisions. Alors, ma question a deux volets. D'abord, ces decision makers, pour qui, en principe, ce travail est fait, quelles décisions prendront-ils? Quelles seraient les motivations de leurs décisions? Ne sont-elles pas de se préserver d'abord eux-mêmes et non pas le mankind future? Et ensuite, vous savez que plus on va vers une démocratie absolue, moins on trouve de decision makers. Et on tend à prouver par ce genre d'études qu'il faut prendre des décisions pour sauver l'humanité et qu'ainsi il faut des decision makers et que ça nous dirige vers une certaine orientation politique.
In English, the Club of Rome group is not at all interested in any political consideration at all. When I mentioned a project about improved decision making, it is independent from the Club of Rome, a project we are following up here in Geneva in order to go deeper into these whole problems. But either a project with us or the Club of Rome's activity certainly would claim in the long run that with better knowledge of a system we are working in will help to make a better decision making. Because we know most of the difficult problems we see today, take the example of a monetary situation. You find nobody who made the decision of changing a currency that he could really predict what the consequences of its measure is. Though if you would understand the interaction worldwide of this system, you could hope that maybe a decision is made in view of a certain consequences. But today you are swimming in these monetary problems, for instance, and there are many other situations too. Though if we have a better understanding of these interactions, we could really hope to do a little better as we do today. That wouldn't mean that we will have a solution to do it in a perfect way. Perhaps never humanity will come to this point.
I want to ask a question to Mr. Koh. I read the Club of Rome report, and to me, all I got out of it was that exponential growth is not supportable, and they didn't claim any definitive results, merely that there would, with exponential growth, be a breakdown somewhere between the next 100 and 1,000 years. Now, you present a model. You actually showed it on the blackboard, or wherever that screen is, with a 1% increase in food production. I should have thought the one thing that one has learnt from the Club of Rome report is to be cautious of putting in exponential growth in anything. A 1% increase in food production would give us 10,000 times as much food production in the world in a few generations as we have now. And if you want to make a model, not for the next 50 years or the next 100 years, but a model for humanity to live in, I think you have to reach an equilibrium somewhere. And I don't think that at any phase in the discussion you can ignore this. Okay. My question is, how can you ignore such a basic idea?
Yes, you're right. The point of our tests was simply to show that on the basis of what we believe to be present trends, or what, not what we believe to be present trends, but what we believe to be possible in terms of technology in, say, agriculture, the results of the limits to growth model are radically changed. In fact, far from being very pessimistic, they become relatively optimistic. Neither are we saying that in the long run we won't have to perhaps head for a different form of society, that growth is totally good. Many of us don't believe this, but what we believe is that within society there are social mechanisms, social forces, which represent the aspirations and expectations of people at large, and that these are present in society now, they're part of present trends in the world, that when people decide that they have grown enough, they will head for a different course. And I think that this is probably what Dr. Taman is suggesting. What we're saying is that at the present time there are many, many people in the world who lead pretty miserable lives compared with our own. That if we were to head for an equilibrium society now, they wouldn't stand a chance. They would be condemned to live in the same conditions as they live now. The time to perhaps turn to an equilibrium society is when everyone in the world has a reasonable living standard. If we cannot achieve a high living standard, then we perhaps ought to think about redistribution of wealth. If it really does seem, when one looks into the problems much more deeply than either we at Sussex or the MIT team have done.
Yes?
What evidence do you have that on one of your solution curves, or those of a more successful model, you'll find a state where the world has a fairly even distribution of resources and not a two-tier or multi-tier world? Okay.
There's a gentleman, Sandy, I can't quite see whether there's a lady or gentleman right up at the back there.
I think my question is similar to Dr. Hyams. He was sort of questioning the parameters which enter your models. What means do you have to adjust these parameters? I mean, where do you take them from, and how do you decide a parameter is good or bad? I mean, most of the parameters, as far as I can see, were taken from the United States and data which were collected there.
We didn't make the model. That, in fact, it's true that it is the developed world which has gathered best statistics, and that Meadows and Co. have had to use US data wherever they have not had good worldwide data. In making our alterations and our tests to the Meadows model, we've been handicapped by the same problem. Problems of information, problems of data, problems of theory are very severe in the social sciences. I think this is something that may seem strange to physical scientists. It's just not possible to estimate, one could say, any numbers well in the social sciences. Even with a very careful population census carried out in Britain, there's a 0.75% error. In the underdeveloped countries, the error of population is up to 15%. And population's just a head count. Recent unemployment figures in Britain show unemployment to be 1.3 million. If one looks at the results of the national census. But on the other hand, if one looks at the Department of Trade and Industry's published figures, it's 0.7 million. There's a 50% error. And this is in a country which has the greatest history of collection of statistics. There really are problems.
Thank you. Yes?
A few of us have been recently playing with the MIT kind of world model here. Originally, we thought that the fancy Monte Carlo techniques which we use every day would bring something new to the model, but we found out very rapidly that probably the problem is not one of mathematical techniques, but uniquely of data and information, as Dr. Kohl pointed out. Still, we found it a fascinating subject, a kind of a modern kind of general culture, pluridisciplinary, which brings it together with people of all kinds of backgrounds and from all kinds of sites.